When I was around 14 or 15, I got a guitar, and I still remember the feeling of just holding it and admiring the aesthetics of it. And I had this sense that I was about to enter a whole new universe with this thing, because it was a thing that you could utilize to transport yourself or other people through vibrations. And it was like an epiphany for me. So I started improvising things on it before I even knew how to tune it, which I guess you could look at like an origin story of sorts, or maybe a warning sign, depending on who you ask. And even at that age, I was already a dreamer who was leaning heavily toward anti-establishment thinking, because I could already see that I wasn't going to fit into that whole framework. And that if I was going to try to fit into it, it was going to be a toxic relationship for me. So I saw music as a way out. And I saw it as a way to just make some sense of my life. Somewhere around that time period, I came across this quote, which gets attributed to Krishnamurti these days, but it might have originated somewhere else. I'm not positive on that. It is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. You've probably heard that before. I mean, it's practically mainstream at this point. In any case, those words at that age, they hit me in such a powerful way. And I sat with it for a while because it gave a name to something that I was already feeling, but I just didn't have the words for it yet. And it helped put into perspective this inner turmoil that I'd been writing off as a personal problem. But suddenly it wasn't really a personal problem. Because it gave me a perspective that the issue was more of a structural problem. And this was probably the first time that I realized that I didn't have to feel all of this guilt for having the feelings and the thoughts that I was having. Maybe it wasn't all my fault. But the thing that doesn't really get mentioned when you have a revelation like this is you still have to live inside of it. And you still have to pay rent inside it. And it doesn't really care what you've figured out. All right, so let's talk about the society in question, because profoundly sick is a pretty strong diagnosis, right? And I think it deserves some unpacking. So I grew up mostly in the 1980s, which had this, I guess, cautious optimism to it on the surface. I mean, let's put it this way. Other than 1984, the word dystopian wasn't really in the vocabulary. So this was back when you could work a minimum wage job and actually still afford your own apartment. Imagine that. And I guess there was this general cultural messaging that if you just worked hard and played by the rules, the system would take care of you, right? If you lived, then you kind of know what I'm talking about. However, underneath all that, if you were paying attention, particularly I'd say in the late 1980s, there was this whole other conversation happening about who the rules actually served. And if you were a perceptive type, you could probably see the culture war being dangled in front of people like a shiny object, while something, having a sense that something a little quieter or more consequential was going on with the money, which ultimately is, class war. None of this, by the way, was anywhere near as obvious as it is these days. And I'm not saying that I had all this figured out at age 15. I didn't. But I could feel it. I felt it like the way that you feel a draft in a room without really knowing exactly where it's coming from. Something like that. And what the system was really asking, I guess what it's always asking, is that if you make yourself useful, you conform, and that you became a resource, a human resource, technically, but a resource first and foremost. If you did that, and you find your slot, you produce and consume, and you don't ask too many questions about, the larger architecture of the thing, and in exchange for your compliance, you get just enough stability to keep showing up, which works fine, I guess. If you're able to just to adjust to ultimately what's an exploitive system, and I guess as long as the version of yourself that fits the slot isn't too far from the version you actually are. But if there is a gap there, and for some people that gap is significant, then the adjustment costs something real that you can't get back. And the thing is, the establishment doesn't really acknowledge that cost because it just relabels it and calls it laziness or instability, or maybe you get the old failure to launch label. So I saw all this at a young age. And I knew that I had to figure something out. And my interest in pursuing music had made this even clearer. It made it very clear to me that I had to find some alternative, if at all possible. So I thoroughly immersed myself into making music independently and rather idiosyncratically, which didn't really help matters. And I want to be honest about that because there's a a version of the story that gets told as pure nobility or something. You know, the artist who refused to sell out, who stayed true to the vision, who sacrificed comfort for meaning. And yeah, all of that was true. But there were also some misguided elements to the process, such as ego-driven endeavors and escapism and bouts with self-loathing and things of that nature. And there was a particular stubbornness of a sensitive person who decided early on that the world wasn't going to tell him what to do, which probably sounds naive and romantic until you're 40 and the rent is still due and you're still having pretty much the same argument with reality that you've been having since you were 17. Reality, just for the record, has never lost that argument, but I've gotten better at making it longer. Anyway, so the years wore on, and there were stretches where the passion I had for this pursuit, this dream, it was so clear that it felt like a physical thing sometimes, like it had some weight or temperature. And then there were of course, the other stretches where I'd wake up and just not want to exist. You know, where the whole project of being a person who does this, it felt colossally exhausting in a way that I couldn't explain to anyone who wasn't already living it. I guess if you know, you know. And I tried a few times to throw in the towel and find the slot and climb into it because the temptation is real. And society offers you this beguiling belief. Right? Where I guess you get to turn off the constant low-grade anxiety of doing things the hard way. But the problem is that every time I got close to it, I couldn't do it. Something in me rejected it, like a bad transplant. Or something. You know, soul crushing is the only way I can describe it in the simplest terms. It's kind of like, I guess, being asked to quietly become someone else and pretend that the original version of you never existed. And by the way, the establishment is totally fine with this. It doesn't need the original version of you. It doesn't care. It just needs someone to fill the slot. You know, keep the machine going. So I kept going with my pursuit of music. Certainly not always gracefully, and not always with any particular sense that I was actually going to go anywhere. I just kept moving forward because the alternative had already revealed itself, and for me that was worse. I think that's the part that people don't talk about when they romanticize the unconventional life. It's not that you're brave or courageous or whatever, it's that the other options turned out to be, for you specifically, genuinely unbearable. And I think that's less of a heroic choice and it's more like a process of elimination. And somewhere in all that, the passion and the apathy started living under the same roof. Some days one has the kitchen, some days the other does. But either way, you got to learn how to cook or you don't eat, right? That's not a metaphor exactly. It's just what it felt like most days. I mean, the thing is, we're all basically puppets. But there's a difference between knowing that and actually trying to take hold of your own strengths. And that difference costs something nobody is going to give you a receipt for. So at some point, the culture decided we needed a word for this exhaustion. And the word they landed on was burnout, which is fine. It's not wrong exactly. I just think it has this temporary quality to it that I find slightly toxically optimistic, I guess. Like, oh, you're burnt out. Take a long weekend, do some yoga, maybe take a bath with one of those fizzy balls, and you'll be back to full productivity on Monday. Problem solved. Oh, and here's a mindfulness app. That'll be $12 a month. There is an entire industry now built around the idea that exhaustion is a maintenance issue. Like you're just a phone that needs charging. And that would be great if that actually worked, but personally, I have yet to meet anyone whose decades-long friction with the fundamental architecture of their existence was resolved by a hot bath and a gratitude journal. Not that there's anything wrong with bathing and journaling. It's just that I think what they're describing as burnout, it's real. I'm not dismissing it, but I think for a lot of people, that's just the surface layer. And what's underneath, there's something colder and less fixable. I think there's a particular exhaustion of functioning inside a system that doesn't make sense for long enough that the effort of pretending that it does, that becomes its own full-time job. Unpaid, obviously, no benefits. So there is a philosopher named Byung-Chul Han, who I've mentioned many times in my videos. And he wrote about what he calls the achievement society, which is the idea that the modern system doesn't burn people out through oppression anymore. It burns them out through self-optimization. So this means that you're not being forced to work yourself to death. You're doing it voluntarily, enthusiastically even. Because the system has convinced you that your productivity is your identity. I mean, what's the first question people usually ask when meeting someone new? What do you do? Yeah. Which I find to be actually worse. I mean, at least the old oppression had the decency to come from the outside, you know? And Neil Postman spent a good chunk of his career essentially saying that the noise is actually the point. And that overstimulation isn't, it's not a side effect of modern media. It's the product. Keep people entertained and fragmented and, you know, keep them slightly overwhelmed, and they'll never quite get around to asking those pesky, difficult questions. And clearly this seems to be effective in our society. The psychologist Martin Seligman spent a great deal of time studying learned helplessness, which is the specific damage that happens when you keep trying to change something and it keeps not changing. And at some point, naturally, the trying just stops. And it's not because you're weak. It's because you're not stupid. Though results may vary there. So all of this drains something that it isn't necessarily energy. I mean, it's a kind of energy, yeah, but I think it's something closer to the will to keep giving a shit. So I don't think I need to go into any more depth about why exactly society is profoundly sick. We all pretty much know by now. I mean, you know, the internet has been pushing this in our faces for the last 25 or 30 years. But one aspect that's relevant to what I'm saying is that there are two major responses that we have to a sick society: burnout and apathy. But there's a difference between these two, and it matters because burnout says, I can't do this right now. But there's still some investment in it, right? There's still a right now that's in there. It's not a complete collapse. There's a implied later. So there's a suggestion that at some point the tank refills and then you're good to go again. Now, apathy, on the other hand, says something different. Apathy says, screw it, I'm done. And I don't really care if this ever gets done. With apathy, there's no implied later. There's just this flat, almost peaceful indifference that kind of settles over everything, like kind of like a light snow, except it doesn't melt. And I think this happens in such a gradual shift that most people don't even notice it until they're already on the other side of it. You wake up one day and you realize that you haven't been burnt out for a while because you've just stopped caring about the thing, the outcome, because you no longer have the capacity. You've been traumatized to the point where it's like you're in the twilight zone of apathy. You really couldn't care less about what anyone thinks of the thing or the outcome. And there's almost a relief in this, which is its own kind of disturbing when you think about it. There is this concept called compassion fatigue that Susan Sontag wrote about. And it's this idea that repeated exposure to suffering and outrage and crisis eventually stops producing empathy and it starts producing numbness. No surprise there, right? And I think that's true, but I think it goes beyond compassion. I think it applies to pretty much everything. If you keep a person overstimulated long enough, you know, you keep the noise loud enough, continuous enough, eventually the nervous system it negotiates like a separate piece. So it stops responding at full volume, which I don't think is weakness. It's just, it's like a thermostat basically doing its job. I think empathy collapse is the part that gets uncomfortable, because you can feel it happening and it becomes very difficult to stop it once you're on that slippery slope. I mean, how exactly are you supposed to care about the rest of the world when you're running on a deficit of caring about your own life, right? And that's not selfishness, that's triage. You just work with what you got. And the noise, you know, the relentless, algorithmically optimized 24-hour noise that's going on, that doesn't help. It's not designed to produce meaning or connection or clarity. It is designed to produce engagement, which is, well, that's a very different thing. Engagement just means you're still looking at it. I mean, you can be completely dead inside and still be engaged, technically. The metrics don't ask how you're doing. Not yet, anyway. And I'm not sure exactly or when exactly caring stops feeling worth the cost. But I don't think it's a conscious decision. It's more like something that happens while you're busy just trying to keep the lights on, you know, trying to keep a roof over your head. Okay, somewhere in the middle of all of this, in my own attempt to mitigate the sick society, I flirted with the concept of non-duality, and I still do to some degree. Though when I was younger, it was in the form of Taoism. Or maybe it flirted with me. Either way, it seemed like we had a mutual attraction. And I want to tread carefully here, because I'm not about to tell you that ancient Eastern philosophy fixed my life. It didn't. But it did give me something that I didn't have before, which was a framework for letting go that didn't feel like giving up. And for someone like myself who was constitutionally stubborn, who'd spent years of white-knuckling his way through his own existence, that distinction was not small. So, all right. So the central idea in Taoism, or one of them anyway, is Wu Wei, which roughly translates to effortless action. It's not passivity exactly. It's more about just not forcing, not clutching, not holding on. you know, it's essentially, it essentially taught me to let go or be dragged. So it's allowing things to move the way they move naturally without spending all your energy fighting the current. And I know that sounds very serene and reasonable until you're actually trying to do it, at which point it turns out to be actually one of the more difficult things a human can attempt, especially if your personality is largely organized around resistance. I think for me, what I actually learned slowly over a long period of time was the difference between holding on to something and carrying it. Turns out you can carry a thing without strangling it. Who knew? And then there were the ego deaths, which actually sounds like a good band name. And yeah, that might sound a little melodramatic, but it mostly just felt like the floor falling or dropping out from under a version of myself that I'd been defending for years. These experiences, they all felt at the time like an inconsolable loss. But the thing is each one turned out to be necessary in a way that only made sense at some later point in time, which is deeply annoying as a system. But apparently that's non-negotiable. So, all right. Viktor Frankl, he wrote about meaning being local, which is to say that you don't need the whole architecture to make sense. You just need something in front of you that does. And not everything. Just this right now. And if you're the type with an inner dialogue, being in the present moment can be pretty difficult, actually. And I think that's where the mortality piece comes back in, because knowing life is short, for me, that was the original engine. That was probably the main catalyst that made me pick up the guitar in the first place, which made the societal machine feel like such an unbearable waste of the very limited time we have available. And it turns out that same awareness, if you can stop fighting it long enough, it's also the thing that makes the present moment not a spiritual concept, but just, it makes it like it's the only thing that's actually here. Everything else is just a delusion, some form of delusion, or as I've heard someone say, anywhere other than this present moment is a form of slavery. So I've been sitting with that alleged Krishnamurti quote for most of my adult life now. And the thing that I keep coming back to is that it doesn't actually tell you what to do. It just tells you what's true. And that's either the most useful thing a quote can do, or the least useful, depending on where you are when you encounter it. But for me, when I was 15, it felt like a door opening up, like it was giving me permission. And it felt like someone had finally defined the thing that I'd been feeling in my chest since I was old enough to look around and think, wait, what? This is what we're doing? This is the plan? Seriously? And now, all these years later, it kind of feels more like a weather report. Fairly accurate, but not particularly actionable. And, well, society is still profoundly sick. I'm still not well adjusted to it. The bills are still due. We still have war and all the same atrocities as ever. You know, when it comes to human nature, it's some things are just remarkably consistent, I guess. I have had this thought lately that maybe the passion and the apathy, they were never really opposites. They were always part of the same thing. So they're two expressions of caring deeply about something on a planet that's largely indifferent to anything that you care about. The apathy isn't really the enemy of passion. It's just, I think it's just what passion looks like when it's tired. And it gets tired. It does get tired. That's allowed under these circumstances. I think the human condition is, it's fundamentally about contradictions. And we spend all of this energy trying to resolve them, when maybe the more honest move would be to just acknowledge that the contradictions don't need solving. They just need living with radical acceptance, which I suppose is a less satisfying answer, but I think it's considerably more accurate as a description of what actually happens. You know, you could argue that we're all just puppets in a sick society, but I've spent my entire adult life trying to work my own strengths, which has been variously, well, exhilarating and exhausting, and of course, occasionally completely absurd. And I don't regret it, because it just, well, I mean, that's just the price of rejecting the so-called well-adjusted life. Nobody told me what that price was going to be. And even if they did, I'm sure I wouldn't have listened anyway. I mean, people did try to dissuade me, of course, but well, that just added more fuel for my own personal little rebellion, I guess. You know, maybe somewhere out there, there's a 15-year-old picking up a guitar. He doesn't know how to tune yet. And I'd really rather not be the one to tell him. I mean, he'll figure it out one way or the other, just like I had to. All right, that's all I've got today. Once again, thanks for listening.